You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, bringing you views of Veterans Day on November 11th. A brief history of how this day came about. An act approved May 13, 1938, made the 11th of November each year a legal holiday to be dedicated to the cause of world peace and to be known as Armistice Day. Primarily set aside to honor veterans of World War I, after World War II required the greatest mobilization of soldiers, sailors, marines, and airmen in the nation's history, and after the war in Korea, the 83rd Congress, at the urging of the Veteran Services Organizations, amended the Act of 1938 by replacing the word armistice with the word veterans. With the approval of this legislation on June 1, 1954, November 11th became a day to honor American veterans of all wars. But this was at least the second attempt to dedicate the world to peace. We can go back to June 4, 1926, when the U.S. Congress officially recognized the end of World War I with these words: "Whereas the 11th of November 1918 marked the cessation of the most destructive, sanguinary, and far-reaching war in human annals, and the resumption by the people of the United States of peaceful relations with other nations, which we hope may never again be severed. On Veterans Day, November 11, 2008, peaceful relations have unfortunately been severed several times, in fact, most recently in Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq. This Veterans Day, we have more veterans than ever before. I want to welcome Michael Blecker, who is Executive Director of Swords to Plowshares, whose mission is to heal the wounds, to restore dignity, hope, and self-sufficiency to all veterans in need, and to significantly reduce homelessness and poverty among veterans. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Susan.
Well, it's good to hear from you, and I want you to first explain to our listeners specifically what Swords to Plowshare does and why it does it.
Well, as you said, I mean, we are recognizing that war causes wounds that last far beyond the battlefield. We are both a direct service provider, where we have a kind of a frontline drop-in center for veterans and housing for veterans and job program for veterans and helping veterans with their benefits. And we also try to affect public policy so that the system of care, and veterans will get their fair share of the system of care and they won't slip into poverty. We can help prevent that. So we both work as a direct provider and also try to affect public policy and involve ourselves in that angle as well.
And you have a view of veterans from, you go back to the Vietnam War.
Well, I served in Vietnam. I was a combat infantryman in Vietnam in 1968, 1969. And I've been working at Swords since 1976. I started out, I was helping veterans with their claims with the VA. It's a lot of interesting aspects to this, but veterans were never allowed to really hire attorneys. There was a $10 attorney fee limitation. So a veteran who had a problem with a disability claim or their benefit from the VA or had couldn't really hire an attorney and pay them more than $10. So veterans have always been sort of denied full representation in terms of struggling for their, quote, entitlements. So that's what Swords did initially, and that was my initial role at Swords. And then just from there, we started addressing the various problems. And, you know, they're essentially problems of poverty. And in the mid-'80s, those problems of poverty started to include homelessness, which was kind of shocking from many of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, very large proportion of the homeless are veterans.
Yes,
rather.
They're far beyond their own representation in the general population. It's also true in most urban areas. Veterans are clearly over a third of the homeless men who are on the streets. In San Francisco, they're barely 11% of the general population, but again, over a third of the homeless population. Mm-hmm. So they're overrepresented in those areas. And so, you know, it's a struggle. It's sort of like a struggle that all groups who are in poverty are waging right now,
mm-hmm.
Struggling to get meaningful care in an economy that has, for the last 30, 40 years, has been sort of shifting away from people's needs. And it's had a big impact and really has generated a lot of suffering.
And it happens a little bit under the radar, doesn't it? Maybe more so now that it's a volunteer military.
Well, I mean, that's true from the standpoint that, we have this, quote, all-volunteer army, though like myself, so many of those who join the military do it to really sort of leave their hometown, seek higher opportunities, go to college, maybe even escape their low-income situations. So it's almost like an economic draft, if you will, even if it's, quote, all-volunteer army.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm certain if you did the demographics and studies of who's joining and who's serving the military, many of whom are, the vast majority, I'm sure, are low-income,
mm-hmm.
from low-income families and low-income backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so certainly.
So obviously it's a population that will be in great need upon their after they return from or after they complete their military service.
And when I say under the radar, I guess what I mean is that it seems as though there's an assumption on, if there's a generalization I can make here, there's an assumption that all of this is being taken care of,
mm-hmm.
and we civilians don't have to worry about it.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there's a sense, although I think that perception has been punctured a little bit with some of the coverage of the way veterans are treated. I think it really, that first big story about how veterans were being treated who were soldiers recovering at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington,
mm-hmm.
and the really shabby conditions they were under, and the lack of attention and care. These are physically paralyzed veterans, and they were treated shabbily, and it was just, I think it really woke folks up, and that became, it's funny, that became a story. They suddenly discovered veterans. Prior to that, it was just how the war was being waged.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sort of realized how shabby the treatment was for our veterans. And so there's been greater attention, I think, paid to the fact that despite, you know, pronouncements, veterans aren't treated very well. And we hear stories about suicide rates and stories about veterans, Iraq vets, Iraq and Afghanistan vets, which is a number of just under 2 million, about 1.8 million have served in the combat zone, are facing very difficult times. Even these foreclosures, et cetera, losing their housing, just facing very, very difficult times. So I think there's a greater awareness of that than, for instance, there was certainly, you know, in the past with World War II and Vietnam even.
Mm-hmm. And, I know, for example, as a human resources of the Pentagon, and I might be wrong there, but his name is David Hsu. His attitude, this was a Bush mm-hmm. administration, his attitude was, we're spending way too much on the veterans. What we need to be doing is spending more money on bullets.
Right. Now, there's always been a major concern in, quote, the cost of war, which they hide from the public, obviously. That's a big part of when war is being promoted. They don't talk about the cost of that war, that it goes, as we say, far beyond the battlefield. And so there are, obviously, there's always people there's a tremendous pressure to sort of like hide those, quote, costs of the war so you can continue waging the war. People really realize that for the next 40 years after the war would end, they would still be paying the terrible cost of that war in the most powerful human terms. Maybe it may be difficult to get support for the war in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's oftentimes there are political ideologues who are placed in the VA and in the Department of Defense, and their job is to contain the cost or hide the cost or, you know, put a public relations spin on what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, certainly. I mean, there's this whole move that just like Social Security and those costs are out of control and need to be managed and need to be cut. You're right. Yes, I'm very familiar with that pronouncement.
Mm-hmm. And are you seeing a lot of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans at Swords to Plowshares at this point?
Well, you got to keep in mind, Swords to Plowshares is, you know, we're a community-based organization that really is, if you will, almost a place of last resort for so many people needing help. They come in states of crisis and crisis, a lot of driven by the poverty and trying to get off the streets. So there's, you know, it's still, the war is still fresh, and so, you know, you don't immediately drop into homelessness when you leave the military. So, I mean, it's certainly a startling revelation that veterans are slipping in, Iraq vets are slipping into homelessness, and we have served some. We have something like close to 10 or 15 veterans in our three housing sites, and we have served close to 200 veterans of the Iraq War in terms of helping them with their disability compensation claims.
Mm-hmm.
So they sought help there. But typically, you know, it takes a certain amount of time to tumble into homelessness and poverty in this country. But it's alarming that the trends are showing that there's more of those veterans who are showing up, really, in those ranks.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the wider implications of war, too. We're talking about veterans in the United States, but uh-huh. if we look back to the war that occurred in Vietnam, we also see a lot of devastation there, don't we?
Oh, well, that's what war is, isn't it? It's massive it's devastation. That's what it is.
In terms
of poverty, in terms of human life, in terms of, you know, every which way, that's what war does.
Yeah, and so I guess my point is that we tend to look at Veterans Day as being applicable to Americans. In fact, I talked to my mother earlier today, and she said that they're celebrating something called Poppy Day, and that's their version of Veterans Day in South Africa. So the wider net cost by war, as you mentioned, we're just beginning to see it in the troops coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. But in fact, the people of Afghanistan and Iraq may even end up in the same predicament that the people of Vietnam have ended up in, which is that there's very little attention here on the devastation caused over there.
Yeah, you know, it's well, you know, it's very painful, I think, for Americans to sort of look up and acknowledge, you know, what were the consequences of acts that were done really in their name, right?
Mm-hmm.
War that's being conducted in their name. And, you know, you would think that history would really put a break on the whole idea of going to war, fighting a war of choice, which is what the Iraq War was, a war of choice. With all this, you know, compelling information, maybe part of that is that history never seeps down into the American people,
mm-hmm.
that there is this devastation because it's not on our shores. You know, we don't have to see it face up. Even the current war, these 1.8 million soldiers who have served in the combat zone, where are they from? They're from the rural areas. They're not from the major communities. They're not the sons and daughters of those who are influential in their society. So in one sense, war oftentimes can be invisible to us as a country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that invisibility allows us to perpetuate it, you know, one might say. Because those who are directly affected by war, they become the ones that know the damage of war. So I think it is very painful for the American people, but they have to see that.
They do have to
see
that.
That's very, very important.
Yeah.
So you're right, it's not just their own countrymen that are affected, or their own countryside, which really has not been affected other than 9/11. But to see the devastation of war, I mean, take a country like Vietnam, where, you know, the amount of bombs and the amount of landmines and just the devastation and the herbicides of a country that was a farming and agricultural country, it's horrific. You know, and it lasts far beyond the war when it's over.
Yeah, we're actually going to be talking with Merle Ratner, who was a coordinator of a delegation that came over here just in the last couple of weeks to try and highlight the devastation and also to pursue the perpetrators of the defoliant Agent Orange.
The manufacturers of
that. Right, and that's an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm.
The case has been thrown out.
I'm sure it's an uphill battle, yeah.
Yeah.
I was in Washington briefly, and we were involved in this coalition of Iraq-Afghanistan war vets that are just a group of 50 other agencies, and some of them are just very small agencies, trying to help both soldiers, their families, and veterans address the needs of war. And there was this convention from the Association of the United States Army, and it was just all the military contractors and every mm-hmm. corporation in this country, whether they make highlighters or social workers or, you know, tanks, helicopters, and it was just – to see it up close like that at a convention like that was just, breathtaking, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just the amount of money that's part of this war effort and who profits from it. And one issue that we have as a organization is that those who secure these federal contracts, they're supposed to at least hire veterans or make some effort to hire minorities or small business or women, especially veterans. And yet there's very little compliance with any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even hire veterans in all these jobs that are created. It's just really atrocious, their mm-hmm. behavior. And they're never held accountable, really.
Michael, let's talk about how Swords to Plowshare is funded.
Well, we're funded by the Department of Labor, and we're funded by our employment training is funded by the Department of Labor, and our housing is funded by HUD through the Homeless McKinney Act and by the VA itself.
Mm-hmm.
We have housing at Treasure Island. I want to say something quickly about San Francisco, which always takes the knock that it's an unpatriotic city or something. We are so lucky to be in San Francisco. Our housing for homeless vets, it's not stuck somewhere hidden in the Tenderloin. It's on a gorgeous Presidio, former military base, has been converted. We have two barracks that we've converted to housing for 100 formerly homeless veterans. We have housing on Treasure Island, which is another wonderful site. It's a gorgeous site, a former naval base that's been decommissioned and put back into use. And we have housing there. We have housing near City College. So we have about 200 units of housing for veterans, mm-hmm. formerly homeless veterans. And it's all in wonderful places in the city. I don't know another city that would allow us that kind of access.
Mm-hmm.
We also get funding from the city of San Francisco to provide mental health care for military veterans. And I think we're the only county in this entire state of California that actually extends its own funding for veterans. Typically, they all, you have to go to the VA for this kind of funding,
mm-hmm.
for this kind of service. So it's, we're just very lucky to be here.
And can troops from other parts of the country come to San Francisco specifically for Swords to Plowshares?
Well, we serve, some of the services are limited to the Bay Area or San Francisco. Some of our legal services, helping veterans with both claims with the VA and who have other non-honorable discharges, can actually get help from Swords Legal Services. And our employment, our help with finding veterans jobs extends into the East Bay. So
okay.
we're able to deliver that kind of employment care to East Bay veterans. But primarily, we see ourselves as a community-based service provider.
Okay.
Our housing is all community-based. And there are a number of groups like Swords that have, established themselves and are at this, sort of represent themselves as a community-based system of care out there. And again, these are groups that would benefit greatly by, some serious changes on the part of federal government from the standpoint of sharing and supporting the urban areas, providing federal assistance. The cities and counties have been in recession for years because they've been dramatically underfunded, as we know. I mean, the state of California is in a budget deficit. The city of San Francisco faces deficits. I mean, we can't even deliver essential services because there have been so dramatic cuts in taxes and the funding being redirected to these military endeavors. We really need to talk about change. Change is really desperately needed just from the standpoint of providing essential care.
And you also, though, have private donations, right? People can get
We sure do.
Yeah.
We just had a Veterans Day dinner on Thursday, and it was wonderful. We had over 600 people that came and supported the organization.
And people can get in touch with you through the website, www.swords-to-plowshares.org?
Yes. Actually, we have a new website. It's stp-sf.org.
Okay, stp-sf.org.
And certainly our phone number, you can call us directly at 415-252-4788. And we can, if you're interested in volunteering or helping us out with a donation, we'd be happy to have that support.
What kind of volunteers are you looking for?
Well, we do events. We're having a big graduation from those who graduate from our housing program on November the 20th.
Hmm.
So oftentimes we need just help with our events and help people provide meals and so forth.
Okay, so again, the events are explained and the dates are on
yes.
the site.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, Michael, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Susan. I appreciate it.
That was Michael Blecker, Executive Director of Swords to Plowshares, based in San Francisco, although they do support certain services in other areas. Get in touch with Swords to Plowshares at www.stp-sf.org or call 415-252-4788. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, you can volunteer at a Swords to Plowshares event, or no matter where you are, you can donate funds for their excellent work or tell a veteran friend about their excellent work. Again, 415-252-4788. Now let's turn to Merle Ratner of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Welcome to Merle Ratner, co-founder and coordinator of Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. It's great to have you with us, Merle.
Thank you, Susan. Happy to be here.
Well, from September 28th to October 31st, 2008, a third delegation from Vietnam visited 10 American cities to highlight the ongoing devastation caused in Vietnam by the war, particularly the use of dioxin-based defoliants. From 1961 to 1971, Dow and Monsanto and 35 other chemical companies made billions of dollars producing millions of liters of Agent Orange and other poisonous chemicals that were sprayed over Vietnam. The chemical manufacturing companies knew that the defoliant was toxic to humans, yet motivated by profit, they refused to take measures to eliminate the dioxin and therefore protect the civilians or the combat troops. And they were not forced to do so by the U.S. government or the Pentagon. So, Merle, I'm going to ask you to give our listeners an overview of the court case and then where it is now, and talk a little about the campaign itself and the women who made up this delegation. So let's start with the court case.
Yes. Well, the Vietnam Association for Victims of Agent Orange Dioxin, which is the Vietnamese organization representing more than 3 million victims of Agent Orange in Vietnam, had brought a court case against all the chemical companies, as you mentioned. They brought it in federal court in New York before Judge Jack Weinstein, who hears all of the Agent Orange cases, including the ones involving U.S. veterans. Judge Weinstein had, unfortunately, and we believe incorrectly, dismissed the lawsuit in 2005. And last year, when our second delegation came, the Court of Appeals heard the case and unfortunately affirmed the dismissal. This time, during the visit of this delegation, the case was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and we were in Washington when the petition for a writ of certiorari asking the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case was filed, and we had a press conference at that time. So we are now waiting for an answer from the U.S. Supreme Court about whether they will hear the appeal.
And when do we expect that?
It should be in the next few months.
Okay. And any ideas of how that's going to go?
You know, it's very, very difficult to say what the U.S. Supreme Court will do. We do know that the chemical companies have asked to file a response, another response, which is, very unusual in a petition for certiorari. But we really don't know what the Supreme Court will do.
So, Merle, the campaign, and now this, as I mentioned, is the third visit from the delegation of Vietnamese who actually are themselves affected by the Agent Orange and dioxin spraying. Would it help to have more people rallying around this? Is there any way of influencing, how people view this, the devastation?
Well, it does help. It certainly helps in terms of putting pressure on the chemical companies and our representatives in the U.S. government. In terms of the court, it's hard to say. I mean, they are people that live in the U.S. and they do generally, get a sense of what's happening in the society, but it's very hard to have direct, pressure on them. But we think that actually there's kind of a turning point going on in this country around Agent Orange dioxin, that there's a growing level of consciousness, there's a growing level of kind of concern and you know, sort of commitment to do the right thing. And we felt that during the speaking tour. You know, there was kind of a new mood in Congress. You know, there was a whole heightened level of interest from students and unions and all kinds of, you know, different groups of people. And the support among veterans, which has been the core in any case, has been growing and growing. We found that as well. And as well, this time we had a much more support from the Vietnamese American community. That's been growing, you know, too.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about the women that came on this delegation.
Well, we had three women. It was an all-women's delegation. The head of the delegation was Dang Hong Yet, who herself is a veteran of the Vietnam War, or as the Vietnamese call it, the American War. She was a member of the Women's Long-Haired Army of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, which was the group of, you know, large group of women that fought against the presence of U.S. troops on their soil. And it's during that period when she was exposed to Agent Orange. She was sprayed. She thought that bombs were coming and went into a shelter. And then when she went out, she found that instead of bombs, they had sprayed. And the spray was all over her. Mm. And she felt sick and developed skin disease and diarrhea. And she thought, you know, initially that that would be it. But then afterwards, she had, you know, multiple miscarriages. She had a baby that managed to stay in her womb for 5 or 6 months. And then they found out that it was severely disabled. Mm. So it was not able to survive and had to be taken out. She later developed cancers and had several tumors removed. And so she's been living with the effects of Agent Orange her whole life. In addition to that, you know, after she was exposed to Agent Orange, she was captured by the U.S. allies in Vietnam at the time, the Thieu regime, and she was severely tortured and put into the tiger cages, which were the infamous prison in Con Dao that had been built by the French and the U.S. Mm. And after she got out of prison and then the war ended, she became a teacher of women's studies and social work. And then after her retirement, she opened a center, one of the best centers in Vietnam, for disabled and Agent Orange-affected children to do vocational rehabilitation. So she's really had a whole life in, you know, as a community organizer, as someone who has served her people, who's been extremely dedicated to the people of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And yet she's been living with this kind of hanging, the effects of Agent Orange dioxin hanging over her head. Mm-hmm. So she was the leader of the delegation. She's also a leader in the Vietnam Association for Victims of Agent Orange Dioxin. The second member of the delegation was Tran Thi Huan, who represents the second generation of Agent Orange victims. Juan is 21 years old. She's a college student in Ho Chi Minh City in information technology, and she lives in the hospital in the Agent Orange ward called Peace Village, where the severely affected children of Agent Orange live. Now, Juan, you know, was not alive during the war. Her parents were not involved in the war. They were farmers. And the way that she got exposed to Agent Orange is that her parents happened to find a dioxin canister, an Agent Orange canister, buried in their field when they were farming. And after her parents were exposed, you know, her mother also had 5 miscarriages and a stillborn child, and Juan was born without 2 legs and 1 hand. Juan, however, despite her disabilities, is one of the lucky second-generation survivors because she has no developmental disability. She's a very, very, very bright and articulate young woman, and as people on the speaking tour heard. And she, however, when she was growing up, people still didn't know much about Agent Orange, so she couldn't go to school. Because, as she told us, the other children were afraid of her, and people thought that they could catch her disability. Mm. So she wasn't allowed to go to school at that time, although now, of course, all children can go to school with that. But she moved to from her village to Ho Chi Minh City at a very early age, and then she went to school and has made it through into college and has a bright future ahead of her despite her disabilities. But she kind of epitomizes, you know, second and third generation people who continue to be injured and maimed by Agent Orange despite the fact that they had nothing to do with the war. She really, you know, she speaks English, and she really kind of made immediate connections with so many young people and all kinds of people. And the third member of the generation was Dinh Thi Minh Nguyen, who was an advisor translator and had been Vietnamese ambassador to several countries. And she was able to translate and also to add her own observations about international law and, you know, how you know, people in Vietnam are seeing Agent Orange dioxin.
And so talk a little bit about that. How are they? I know that the last time was it June when the Court of Appeals threw the case out. There was a lot of reaction in Vietnam. Talk a little
right.
bit about that.
Right. I mean, this is a top issue in public opinion in Vietnam. First of all, there are, you know, 3 to 4 million victims, so everybody knows someone or is affected themselves from this. From the top of the country, you know, from the national leadership down to the hamlets and villages and communes. So this is a top area of concern. The Vietnam Association for Victims of Agent Orange is active in almost every province. Youth are involved in volunteering in Agent Orange villages. Women's Union has big programs on this. The Red Cross and the, you know, the Government Committee on Agent Orange and the government social welfare committees are all very much involved in multiple layers of programs. The Vietnamese government assists its own victims as much as it's able with cash grants and free education and health care and other services. So whenever anything happens around Agent Orange, you know, it's top news in Vietnam. And, you know, this is the case as well. I should mention that our last delegation that was here when the Court of Appeals hearing happened, when they went back, Mrs. Hong and Mr. Kui died. They were the two members of the delegation who were suffering from Agent Orange-related cancers, mm-hmm. and they were in the terminal stages of cancers when they very bravely, you know, decided to come anyway to the Court of Appeals hearing. And they completed the tour in great pain and with great bravery, and they went back and they died within 2 weeks. So the urgency of our campaign to achieve justice and compensation for Vietnamese Agent Orange victims has never been more clear, because people are dying, you know, day by day in Vietnam. And also we have several members of our board who are U.S. veterans affected by Agent Orange who have died as well.
Mm-hmm. And when the delegations are, when the delegates are here, are you able to get to the chemical companies themselves and introduce?
We went to Midland, Michigan with the last delegation, and they, of course, refused to talk to us. But we did meet with local people in Midland who were affected by the dioxin contamination of their own land. This time, we did not go to Michigan, but a local newspaper reporter in San Francisco did get a comment from Dow Chemical. And, you know, believe it or not, after all these years and all the scientific evidence, they're still saying that dioxin Agent Orange doesn't cause what happened to the people. Mm-hmm. It's not responsible. It's not their fault. It's perfectly safe. Mm-hmm. And they really, you know, they continue to lie about it.
They're actually saying it's still perfectly safe?
Yeah, they're saying it doesn't, mm-hmm. well, they're saying it doesn't cause, they're because. Saying that there was dioxin only in trace elements and it didn't cause the injuries of the veterans
uh-huh.
on both sides.
Uh-huh.
So their position, and they actually lied about the scientific evidence. They said that the scientific evidence shows it doesn't cause these things.
Mm.
So they're basically flat out lying, and that's why we've launched a corporate campaign to hold Dow and Monsanto, among the 37 chemical companies, accountable for what they've done, and to basically, you know, call them out and to say that they can't advertise themselves as they do as socially responsible companies unless they compensate their victims and own up to what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
So we've launched this campaign and we're going to be following up on that. And we've also started a campaign to ask the U.S. Congress and ask our representatives in the U.S. Congress to initiate legislation to provide massive social compensation to Vietnamese Agent Orange victims, to clean up the hot spots where the chemicals remain in the land in Vietnam, and also to do something for the children and grandchildren of U.S. veterans who receive nothing now from the U.S. government, and for the Vietnamese Americans who are exposed and live here now and also receive no services at all.
And what kind of money are we talking about? What is the suit against Monsanto and the chemical companies?
It's from, you know, multi-millions of dollars.
Uh-huh. And for them, this is not an unreasonable amount, given that their profits are extraordinary.
Right. These are two extremely profitable companies who continue to make money, are not facing financial problems. And I should say, you know, they're doubly culpable because the dioxin that is the killing element in Agent Orange is not even the active element for defoliation. In other words, Agent Orange, to do its work of you know, defoliating the trees, which is what it was intended to do initially, does not require dioxin. Dioxin is a byproduct of sloppy, quick and dirty manufacturing. Mm. And the chemical companies of the time knew they were making a supremely toxic dioxin and that they could fix that by controlling for time and temperature in the manufacturing process. But because they were so greedy for profit, because the U.S. government was buying it as quickly and irresponsibly as they could, they just ignored that and just said, we'll make it quick and dirty so that we can make more money, and, you know, it doesn't matter what the effects are on the people of Vietnam or on the veterans, so that they knew they were making the most toxic, you know, Agent Orange they could make. And the irony of not only, you know, making a product that was dangerous, but making it when they could have fixed it, you know, is something that makes them double, triple culpable.
Well, listeners can go to the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign to learn more, which is http://vn-agentorange.org. You have a lot of facts about the chemical itself on that website, and I really urge people to go and read that because it is an eye-opener.
Yes, yes. We have a lot of facts. We have some videos you can use to do educationals in your community. We have information on what you can do in terms of the, you know, asking the government and the chemical companies to take action. And we also have a resolution of a policy statement of the American Public Health Association on there, which puts on record the world's largest public health association is saying that there is a responsibility from the government and chemical companies to take action on this as a public health issue.
And Merle, you mentioned videos. You showed one at the recent San Francisco event for the delegation. And is there a way that people can see that or purchase that from the website?
There is a longer version of that video on the website that people can see for free. It's on the left hand of the first page of the website down a bit. And if people want copies for showing the communities, they can write to the email on the website and we will get the materials and videos.
Well, Retna, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Susan.
Again, learn more about the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign by going to their website at www.vn-agentorange.org. We've done several shows on the different delegations that have come to the United States from Vietnam to highlight the ongoing effects of Agent Orange dioxin, and you can listen to those on our archive site, www.raisingsandradio.org. The ongoing effects of war is a central theme at Raising Sand Radio, from the environment to the ongoing human costs. Again, www.raisingsandradio.org. We also have a blog, which is http://raisingsandradio.blogspot.com. We're now going to turn to a veteran of the Vietnam War, Jim Janko. We've heard from Michael Blecker of a veterans organization. We've heard from Merle Ratner, who is the coordinator of Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. And now we're going to turn to Jim Janko, who was an Army medic during the Vietnam War. And Jim Janko did something quite extraordinary at the delegate event in San Francisco recently that Mill Ratner was coordinating. And he gave his Purple Heart to one of the delegates, and he gave his combat medical badge to the second delegate. And Jim, I'm going to invite you to tell our listeners a little bit about your story in Vietnam and your experiences as a vet, and then why you decided to give these very prestigious badges to these delegates.
Since I was a medic in Vietnam, I was with the 25th Infantry, and we were in the Cu Chi area and the Thay Ninh areas. And these areas were very heavily bombed and very heavily sprayed with Agent Orange. I gave my Purple Heart to Mrs. Dong, one of the members of the delegation that was recently in San Francisco. And she was in these areas, in the Cu Chi area. She was in the Thay Ninh areas. So she, too, was wounded, not by the bombs that were incessant during the war, not by the ambushes of search and destroy missions of platoons such as the one I was in, but by chemicals. So I wanted my Purple Heart to mean something that would unite people, to unite, in this case, those we once called the enemy. I'll talk a little bit about that day when I was wounded. We were in open farmland in the Cu Chi area, and we were set up outside a village. And I told the lieutenant I was going to just go into the ville where we'd just passed a well a few minutes earlier to fill up an extra canteen. And my best friend in the war, his name was Robert Boschool, he said, "I'll come with you." And I didn't ask him to come with me. He just, he wanted to be with me, I guess. And I went first, and I tripped a booby trap. And my wounds were relatively minor. I got shrapnel through my hand and in my leg. And he got just ravaged by it. He was killed. And he was only 19, but he had great heart. There was a bigness in him. And when I was giving this medal away, I was thinking of him. I was thinking of this ravaged landscape. And I was thinking of, Mrs. Dong being in this area. Mm. Not at the same time I was, but being in this area too. And that's why I gave her my Purple Heart.
Hmm. And you were thinking of your friend at that time.
Yes, I was.
Yeah. And Mrs. Dong seemed to be surprised, so I guess she had no idea that this was going to be given to her.
She knew that she was going to receive something, but actually she did not know what it meant at the time I gave it to her. I talked to her the next day. And, it wasn't until later that night when they were looking at it and the interpreter was explaining what all this was that she had any sense of what this medal meant.
And, Jim, you've had this medal for, what, 35 years?
38 years. A little over 38 years, yeah.
So, and during those 38 years, this medal has, signified a time in your life that, really the time that defined you as a veteran, didn't it?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, for 38 years. I mean, this medal, whether your wounds are, a little shrapnel or you lose an arm or a leg or a life, there's a Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, I've always in some ways felt responsible for my friend's death.
Mm.
I tripped the booby trap. But I've also used this medal to remember just the goodness of the young man's heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot begin to imagine, what he would do if he could do something with his Purple Heart. I cannot call that one, but I feel that he would approve of what I did because it is something that brings people together, that invites us to see each other in a deeper way and invites us to be friends after many long years.
Yeah.
You know, during the war, you know, of course, the Vietnamese and the Americans were separated, but now that's not the case. There's nothing to divide us, and at bottom, I don't think there ever was.
Mm-hmm. And so have you thought about that badge since giving it to her, which was now about a week ago, 10 days ago, right? Have you...
I've thought about it a lot in two respects. First, she was in an area that was just so obliterated by bombs and chemicals. And I grew up in a small town in Illinois, and one of the things that really put me against the war when I went there, not knowing anything, I wasn't for it or against it when I got drafted, but one thing that really turned me against that war was that the landscape was so ravaged, and the farms were bombed, and villages were bombed. And I grew up in a small Illinois town with cornfields and bean fields, and I couldn't help wondering, what if these were our fields? You know, how would we feel?
Mm-hmm.
And the sheer scope of the destruction was just, you know, beyond my ability to describe, but I knew it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking of Mrs. Dong in this area, beneath all the might of the American military,
mm-hmm.
and how this, you know, small in stature, this small woman facing so much, the whole American arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it, been thinking a lot about my friend,
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, just one lapse in Vietnam, you don't see it. It was a tripwire that, mm-hmm. that I hit.
Mm-hmm.
One lapse, you know, you're not looking, you're not paying attention for a little while, and consequences are huge.
Mm-hmm. He'd come with you out of friendship, too, to make sure that you were going to be okay.
Excuse me, I didn't...
I said he came, with you out of friendship, too. He didn't have to come with you on
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came strictly out of friendship.
Yeah.
I mean, he was... We just had a... Bo School and I had just an immediate bonding. You know, we were both athletes. We were both we both had a swagger back then, and he was just a really good soul. Also from the Midwest, we loved each other.
Mm-hmm. Now you also gave your combat medical badge to the young woman Tran Thuy Huan, who is the 21-year-old college student who was second generation, born without legs due to the exposure to Agent Orange.
Yes, I gave Ms. Tran my combat medical badge, and this is a badge that a medic receives after being in combat, and I was in quite a bit of combat. And I gave it to her. I feel like Ms. Tran, who's, I think, 20, 21, just a delightful young woman, she and Mrs. Dong are in part doing the work of medics. I mean, one thing a medic needs to do is to bring attention to suffering and then respond to it. You know, when I was in Vietnam and when my platoon got hit, when somebody got shot or there was a booby trap, I had to go out to that person. Whatever the conditions, I had to go out and make it to whoever was hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like these people going on a 10-city tour, you know, 30 days in the U.S. and 10 cities, San Francisco included, they're going out to tell us of the wounded, to tell us, look, there's still a lot going on. Tens of thousands of Vietnamese, not merely Mrs. Dong and Ms. Tran, have been affected by Agent Orange.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice way to look at it. I really like that. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, you yourself, have you suffered from the effects of Agent Orange?
You know, I have to say that I don't know. We filled our canteens from wherever we could, streams, rivers. I even recall once filling my canteen in a puddle. And, you know, we just put in iodine tablets and drink it. And I did lose 30 pounds when I was in Vietnam. I had came back with a very different constitution. Went there bulky and very athletic and strong, and came back thin and a bit delicate in health.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been that way since. It really changed my whole metabolism. And whether that was Agent Orange or whether the stress and the trauma
mm-hmm.
that I witnessed, it's impossible for me to say.
Mm-hmm.
I know, you know, Agent Orange does affect the immune system, and the science of immunology is in its infancy, and people get all kinds of odd symptoms that doctors can't figure out.
Right. Something like the Gulf War syndrome that we hear
exactly.
so much about. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think that's it's related to the immune system also.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for spending this time with us and telling the story of your time, the brief portion of your story about Vietnam, and also what motivated you to give away your medals. Do you have any medals left at this point?
Not really. I gave away my Bronze Star for Valor back in the 80s, protesting the wars in Central America.
Mm.
I got that medal on a day when there were so many casualties, I ran out of bandages.
Mm.
And, I received that medal for trying to save lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sent it back to Washington through Veteran Speakers Alliance. And I think there was another Korean War vet, Ralph Webb, I believe, gave his Purple Heart. Sent that back to Washington.
Mm.
So, yeah, my medals are there. I feel like I've used them in the best ways that I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I have just a lot of admiration for these Vietnamese, Mrs. Dong and Miss Tran. And, Miss Dong, she has cancer, but the strength of her spirit is just phenomenal. I just am amazed by her. And Miss Tran is so bright and energetic and lively. And I see, despite her physical limitations, I see great things for her.
Mm-hmm. And any last thoughts about Veterans Day, the symbolism of Veterans Day for you?
Well, for me, Veterans Day is a day first to try to prevent war, do whatever one can to prevent war. The truth is, if somebody goes to a war and sees combat, there's going to be damage. And, I think when veterans come back, there's all this attention now about we have to treat veterans well when they come back. And I'm 100% behind that, 110%. But also, even more importantly, we have to prevent war and abolish it as a means of national policy.
Mm-hmm. Well,
once a person goes to war and actually sees combat, there's going to be an everlasting impact.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Susan.
And that's our show for today. I wish you the best for Veterans Day, and thanks for listening to Raising San Radio on KZSU Stanford. As usual, all views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU Radio or Stanford University. Tune in again next week when author and political psychologist Peter Dunlap will join us to present ideas for changing our political culture and increasing our capacity for engaging change within the groups that we may work with, as well, and perhaps more importantly, within ourselves. We'll go out with Griffin House and It's Happening Again. ¶¶
grandpa fought in World War II. My uncle fought in Nam. My father was too young. He went to school and met my mom. And her dad always told us stories around dinner time. And there's one he told when I was young that sticks out in my mind. He said 10 years after Daddy taught me about the birds and bees, I was stranded in Pearl Harbor fighting off the Japanese. When the kamikaze pilots came and dove in without warning, I was on the Arizona on a warm December morning. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older and it's happening again. It was hard to have forgiveness for the things they did that day, and our president decided we should make their people pay. So we dropped on Nagasaki and we cut him down to size. And the one we dropped on Hiroshima left him vaporized. And I heard some Christians say, what would Jesus do? What if you were on the wrong side? Would he point the gun at you? And they read through every word of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, so they could see if killing was the side that Christ was on. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older, and it's happening again. They separate the church and state and keep God out of school so our governments can educate based upon their rules. The people start to wonder if our politics makes sense when religion is our best excuse for national defense. And when our citizens start saying that our wars are not okay, and Washington keeps telling them God loves the USA, and they teach us history so we can learn from our mistakes, and this generation wants to know how many years it takes to change the way we treat our neighbors all across the land. 'Cause if we don't change our hearts, we repeat the past again. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now we're older and it's happening again. Grandpa finished talking, we went walking, he and I. I was thinking of the future and how scared I was to die. Now my best friend's overseas, in the desert where it's dry, fighting for our country, and I need a reason why. I remember when he was a younger man. Now he's a soldier fighting in a foreign land. Now we're older. God bring him home again.